the Financial Sense Lifetime Planning Program. Here's your host, Jim Poplava.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to Lifetime Planning. Well, today we're going to do a special show with my guest. We have had a lot of response from listeners in special requests. Could you do a show on special needs trust? And that's exactly what we're going to be doing on the program today. Joining me on the program is Hal Wright. He is author of the book, The Complete Guide to Creating a Special Needs Life Plan. Hal, as we get into this topic, I wonder if you would explain for our listeners, especially those who may not be familiar with it, what a special needs trust or a disability trust is. What makes it different than, let's say, a living trust, a revocable trust?
I hate to give you kind of a long-winded explanation, but it starts with federal government policy. And the policy of the federal government, there are three programs to help people with disabilities that are means-tested, meaning you basically have to qualify as living in poverty to get them. Social Security's Supplemental Security Income, Medicaid, and the Home and Community-Based Services for people with an intellectual disability. The income limit is varying. There's a computation there, but basically it's going to be less than $2,200 a year. The person can also only have $2,000 in financial assets. So in order for someone to access these government programs, they have to live in poverty. And then the question comes, how can a family put their money aside to help their child have the best possible quality of life? And the Social Security Act has a provision for doing that called a supplemental needs trust. If the appropriate language is in that trust, a person can be eligible for means-tested government benefits, and third parties, that is families, grandparents, parents, whoever, can put money aside to help that person. The key thing about a special needs trust, in order that it cannot be counted as the person's assets, is the person can have no control over that trust, no right to distributions, or any legal means to compel distributions. Consequently, the trustee of that trust has to have absolute and sole discretion on disbursements. And if that trust is properly structured, Social Security and the Medicaid people will accept it to allow families to help out their child. One other point I'll make on this, and that there's really two trusts here. There's a classic supplemental needs trust. There's also a disability trust. With affluent families, you will more often find a disability trust because most affluent families don't want to deal with the problems of quality, reliability, and access to government benefits. They will use a disability trust. And the key difference is, in a disability trust, they can put prescriptive language in that trust that compels distribution for the purposes that the settlor wishes. So there are two types of trusts. For 95% of the families need government assistance to create the best possible life for their child, and they will use the classic supplemental needs trust. Sorry for the long explanation.
No, that's good, because we want to clarify what it is, how you qualify, when it is appropriate. And I might want to point out, Hal, if you'd share a little bit of your personal story, because you got involved in this because you have a child that is a special needs child, and eventually you became an expert in this area and wrote a book on it.
Yes, I actually, if people ask me who I am as a person, I start with the fact that I have an adult daughter with Down syndrome. My wife and I and my daughter are very proud of the fact that she has lived in her own apartment now for 4.5 years. When we first started trying to figure out how we could provide for Meg's future, we searched for a financial planner to help us and couldn't find any. And that's what led me to start my own financial planning practice, get my CFP designation, and I worked almost exclusively with families that had a loved one with disability. And the reason why we couldn't find a financial planner to help us, the biggest question we had was, how much money are we going to have to set aside to support this child for the rest of her life? And we couldn't find a financial planner that knew how to answer that question. And that's when I started my own practice. I focused on how to bridge between a life plan and a family's financial and estate plans.
You approach this subject from not only your own experience with your own child, but also from a different approach. Let's talk about life planning, the things that go into it, the resources, finances, and legal, because this isn't, you know, it's not as simple as most people think it is.
Actually, a good way to start it off is to describe what Eleanor and I want for our daughter, Meg. When friends ask us what we want for her, we say we want her to have friends, a job, and a home. We want her to be happy, and we want her to have the life she wants for herself, and we want her to be safe and cared for when we're no longer here. So it's about a quality of life. It's about the life that Meg wants for herself, and it's about her protection. Now, It's easy to say that, but more complicated to deliver in life. And so the approach that I developed for special needs planning had two fundamental principles. One was, if we want to deliver the best possible life for a person, we focus on their capabilities, not their disability. And another thing that parents need to understand is it's the government policy to provide for a person with a disability at the poverty line or less. If families want a quality of life for their child, they're going to have to find out how to pay for it. And when I was in CFP practice, it was a poignant dilemma that I often struggle with when the family's wishes for their child were simply not affordable. But what I had to do as a financial planner was figure out where that affordability was, and if we could go beyond that to the best possible quality of life, and that was a win-win.
You know, one thing I've found in my years of experience in planning, Hal, and I'd like to get your comments, and this is a situation, let's say parents have, let's say, three children. One of them is a special needs child, and of course, that child is going to need more assets to bring that quality of life, and there simply may not be the assets there to bring that about. What we have found to be an effective tool is to fund, for example, a life insurance program, that the assets would be there without depleting the estate and, let's say, not necessarily disinheriting, but leaving very little for the children that were well. In your experience, what role does life insurance play in special needs?
It's essential. Most families actually have less life insurance than they really need because nobody really computes the expenses. Usually life insurance is sold on the basis of family income. But the life insurance is essential for a couple of reasons. First of all, it's the most tax efficient way to fund a special needs trust. The worst way you can fund a special needs trust is with a retirement plan because the tax implications there are pretty tricky. Another reason why life insurance is so important is I believe that families who have a baby born with special needs ought to start planning for their future. Because for one thing, they need to plan on what would happen if something happened to them. And because this happens to younger families, they haven't built the wealth up yet to take care of that child. Life insurance is going to be the best way to create a legacy in your younger working years. And in the three different basic types of life insurance, term, whole life, and second to die, term insurance becomes a very good way for families starting out to fund the child's legacy. They should begin to bring in permanent life insurance at some point. And because half of all the children with intellectual disability will outlive both parents, second to die life insurance can often play a very good role there because it's cheaper than single life insurance. When I was in CFP, when you do a cash flow plan for a family over their working lives or their retirement years, and I had to extend that to the child's probable age of mortality, you can almost see how the pieces of life insurance can fit together as time goes on.
What do you do when the family simply doesn't have the funds? They're just an average family. They have a child that has special needs. There just isn't the assets there. Or let's take even a more extreme situation. They don't have the money to fund the insurance. What do you do then?
Then they're going to have to make sure they've structured their family circumstances to be able to access government services. It's true that government services will only support a person at the poverty line or somewhere below. And actually, Social Security supplemental security income, $771 a month, is only 74% of poverty. If that's all families have, then we do the best we can with what we have to work with. And my focus is making sure they understand government benefits, they understand the eligibility criteria, they've set themselves up to where their child will be eligible. I still think that early on, hopefully there's money for at least term insurance, because the real fear I have is an automobile wreck kills both parents and that child is now left alone. And I hate to think of someone being left alone where all they can rely on is government help.
And Hal, what happens in a situation, let's say there is a special needs child, something tragically happens to the parents, like you mentioned, maybe they're killed unexpectedly in an accident of some sort. Where does that leave the child? I mean, a lot of times you hear about orphans that go to orphanages. What happens when it's a special needs child?
There's two circumstances that often I encounter here. One is a special needs child will draw a family together more often than not. It's drawn our family closer together. It also will stretch a fragile relationship to the breaking point. And what I've encountered frequently in my years in this business is divorce in the special needs child. But let's not go there and stay with your question. Typically, I've seen three generations of family members looking to help support this child: grandparents, parents, and the child's brothers and sisters. And that leads to the concept of developing a lifetime circle of support for that child. And so often when I work with families that have these resources, a strong family, a structure of community friends, you know, we try to create a circle of support, write a letter of intent for that child to guide that circle, and it's the circle that's going to sustain that child for their lives. The problem is going to be families that, for whatever reason, a divorced single mom, for example, who's going it alone, and there I try to help make sure she's connected with community resources like the ARC chapters and across the country, or the Down Syndrome Associations or the Autism Societies, because I really want to try to create a support network for the family, for especially like a single parent, so they don't have to go it alone. It's tough enough, but if you can find the people that can help you on that road, it's worth more than any amount of money you can imagine.
Well, what about a situation, let's take a family that is fairly affluent, and let's just make this easy mathematically. They have three kids, and they have $3 million in assets, investable assets. Because money doesn't buy what it used to, in other words, you can't earn as much interest on money today. It may sound like on $1 million, hey, you're a millionaire, but $1 million doesn't buy what it did 10, 20 years ago. What does a family in that situation do? Do they take some of the assets, and would you recommend supplementing it with life insurance if their goal is to provide for this child that's going to have special needs, but at the same time, they also want to leave a legacy to the two other children?
Yeah, one reason I used to love doing financial planning, because it really is an art, creating the best possible picture of a life. But before going to your question, I will mention one thing. Financial planning has always been about values. And the crucial value here is, and I have it with my family because I have three children, what's fair to all the children? Meg has her needs, and we've pretty much identified what that is. To fund her trust in a net present value sense today is about $500,000. And Meg has an older brother and sister, and their circumstances in life are different. So what is the fairness in balancing our legacy to those children? That is one of the most, I think, important conversations that a family can have. But to your question, I used to think early on that life insurance was the important thing until I had a woman come to me named Barbara. She was 88 years old and had a 38-year-old son. And I asked her, I said, well, Barbara, what would you like to have happen? And she said, I need to lay it all down. She had gotten to the point with age where she just couldn't continue. And it's a really poignant moment when a mother says, I have to give up the care of my child. It taught me a lesson that life insurance is great, but you have to consider that the trust may need to be funded while you're still alive because of the diminishments in your retirement years. And I often feel that it takes a mix of assets and insurance to fully provide for the entire family.
And Hal, what about a situation? Okay, so you set up this special needs trust, you're funding it with assets and may be funded with insurance. What about an independent trustee that's going to manage those assets for the benefit of the child? Because the child may not, in most cases, be capable of making financial decisions or managing a substantial investment portfolio.
I think that most parents think that, well, I know best what to do with for my child, and that's true. But managing a special needs trust, whether it's a life insurance trust or an asset trust, requires sophisticated financial skill. It also requires an understanding of the law. And I counsel families that you either should be thinking about a professional fiduciary, or if you are fairly astute and competent in business, perhaps you can hire someone to advise you. But I think in the long run, especially for the child that outlives parents, the fiduciaries that understand how to manage taxes, how to maximize investment returns, they can create wealth for that child that most parents can't. And so, yes, I'm a great believer in fiduciaries. However, the selection of one is complicated. And I do work with high net worth families, and I'm very well aware of the structure of family offices and how those trusts are set up for dynastic wealth families. And those families frequently use a distribution committee for the beneficiary. They often use a committee to help enhance the life of the person who's the beneficiary, what I call the circles of support. And when it works well, you have multiple parties, each taking a role that they're best qualified to execute.
I want to move on to other situations, and that is Let's talk briefly about the available government programs, both at the federal level and at the state level. Let's begin with what's available to families at the federal level.
At the federal level, you basically have Social Security and you have SSI. Social Security is an entitlement program. You're entitled to benefits because you paid taxes or because your parent paid taxes. In my case, my daughter is entitled to a Social Security check because I paid taxes and I'm now retired at 71. In terms of health care, it's Medicare and it's Medicaid. And for some people with disabilities, like my daughter works, and so she has a salary where she pays Social Security and Medicare taxes. At some point, she had earned enough work credits to receive her own Social Security check, and that also with it came, after 2 years, Medicare eligibility. So my daughter is a Medicare, Medicaid dual eligible. The actual services at the state level for a person in the community is called the home and community-based services. And usually there's pretty much the same services nationwide: supported living services, comprehensive services, children's extensive services. Generally, the state programs are 50% state funded, 50% federal. The programs follow the federal eligibility guidelines. And so for your state disability services, you usually have an income limit and an asset limit to qualify. But that's the basic structure. Two income programs, Social Security and SSI for those who live in poverty. Two health insurance programs, Medicare and Medicaid. And then the actual services that people with disabilities receive in the community.
All right, let's move on to some of the options that are available at the state level. And let me ask you this. If a parent or child is receiving benefits at the federal level, does that negate or subtract from any benefits they're receiving at the state level?
It's really complicated, but basically, if you are judged by the Social Security Administration at being eligible for SSI, which by definition means you're disabled and living in poverty, in two-thirds of the states, Medicaid is automatic. In one-third of the states, you have to separately apply to Medicaid. You can get the state home and community-based services over and above that because HCBS is not income to the child. The $771 a month that SSI has is for personal expenses. Also, they have their health insurance. The HCBS services are for things like job support, transportation in the community, someone perhaps to their case manager for government benefits. So home and community-based services pays for things that Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid do not. And so there's usually, although they are tied together, the getting one does not sacrifice the other. The problem is if the child with a disability has income, and what happens then is if they're getting SSI, they lose a dollar of SSI for every dollar of unearned income, 50 cents for every dollar of earned income. And you can get, if you have a good enough wage, SSI can get driven to zero. And if it does, you can lose your Medicaid. So a lot of these families are walking a tightrope in trying to preserve eligibility for benefits, at the same time trying to create some minimal life for their child. It's a complicated system, and it is malicious if you make an inadvertent mistake. It's important to be working with somebody who really understands how all the parts fit together.
Yeah, because I can imagine being disqualified from one program because you didn't do things properly or you were getting benefits in another program. As we talk about this subject, where are the first steps? Let's say we have listeners out there and we've had a request for doing a show like this. If you're a parent, have a child that has special needs, where do those parents begin or parent?
Let's hopefully take the situation where the child is young, the parents are starting out. Probably the most, by the way, when I was doing life planning and financial planning for these families, I do age-appropriate planning. There are things you do when the family has a child who's 5 years old, far different than 18 years old. The family starting out, the first thing that they need to do is to make sure they have a plan for someone to take care of that child if something happens to them. They also need to do their basic estate planning documents. Their wills, they should set up a special needs trust, even though it's not funded. It'll sit there on the shelf. It'll be a shell trust or pour over trust in case something happens to receive life insurance or whatever. But at least have a plan for how your child will be taken care of. As you move into middle school, the focus in the school system, for instance, in the IEPs, the individual education plan, starts to become the job skills the child will need to get a job when they get out of school. Toward the high school period, you're starting to plan for the child as an adult in the community. If you have the life plan, at some point, And I believe that families really should do financial planning, and even though they're going to have to pay for it. You really should have a family financial plan that charts this future out so that you can have the life insurance, a plan for accumulating the assets to take care of that child as an adult. And you also need to do estate planning, because that's how you pass a legacy on to all of your children. It's complicated to view this journey, this lifelong journey, and all of its moving parts. It's one reason I wrote my book, because I wanted that book to be a resource for families to figure out how they could take control of their future and their child's future. And part of that is the families are going to have to rely on ethical and competent professionals to give them good advice. I think financial planning is an honorable profession, and I think we financial planners can really help families to a better life. And I do hope families will not go it alone, that they'll reach out to competent professionals to help them.
Hal, as we close, why don't you tell our listeners about your book, which I would recommend as a starting point if they're facing a situation where they have a child that needs or has special needs, and where they can get it.
The book was published by Jessica Kingsley of London, England. Actually, Kingsley is a prominent publisher in the world of autism and Asperger's syndrome, and they're also a prominent publisher in the fields of social work and education. And this book came out in 2003. And it's available on Amazon.com. It's titled The Complete Guide to Creating a Special Needs Life Plan, a comprehensive approach integrating life, resource, financial, and legal planning to ensure a brighter future for a person with a disability. By the way, this title came up from the publisher's marketing department. I loudly objected to the number of words, but they say, oh, we do this because people do keyword searches on the internet. Anyway, the book is 360 pages. It has four case studies in it. Each case study is 25 pages, so actually 40% of the book is case study. I wanted people to see what it looked like in real life. The first case study is an affluent family with an 18-year-old daughter with Down syndrome. The second case study is a single mom, an assistant librarian, ergo not much money, with a teenage son with Asperger's syndrome. The third case study was a working-class couple who had an 18-year-old daughter who's blind. And the fourth case study is the hardest challenge of all. That's the adult male with mental illness, type 1 bipolar disorder. I wanted people not only to understand how to go about it, I also wanted them to understand how hard it can be, and I wanted them to understand and have the hope that they could create a better life for their child. When my daughter was born, Rocky Mountain Down Syndrome Association assigned my wife and I to an older family to help us get through that first year, to learn the future that we would face and how we could cope with it. And I'll never forget something that Bill told us. He said, it will never be as good as you hope, but it will never be as bad as you fear. And we learned that that's true. It's been a hard life, but it's been so spiritually rewarding. And like I say, it's drawn our families together. I think I'm a far better person for having Meg in my life. And what I hope in this book, that I've balanced the challenge that families face with what I think is a realistic hope that their child can have a good life.
Well, I tell you, it's so important. I'm glad somebody like yourself has written a book like this. Even in my own family, I have a brother, a special needs brother. He lost his hearing due to an illness at an early age. And upon my mother's death, everything was put in place in this special trust, so he'll be taken care of the rest of his life. And you're absolutely right, Hal. Doing the planning up front, addressing these issues, being aware of the different programs, and then putting a plan into effect, and then having all members there to assist, not just, let's say, one brother or one sister, but the whole family, really can make a difference. Hal, can they get this book on Amazon?
Yes, and actually, because it was published 6 years ago, Amazon is probably the best source. It also may be in your local library, because when the book came out, the Library Journal, which is the professional publications for the librarians, gave it a star rating, and the tag on the star was verdict essential. And I think about 770 library systems in this country at one time at least had it on shelves and may still do. But Amazon's a good place to get it.
All right, let me give out that book title. It's called The Complete Guide to Creating a Special Needs Life Plan. And the author, my guest, Hal Wright, that's W-R-I-G-H-T. Hal, I want to thank you for joining us on the program. We've had requests to do this, and having gone through this in my own family with one of my brothers, and of course, in your own situation, made it much more meaningful. Thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
And good luck to you, and good luck to your listeners.
You know, I hope you found this a useful program. We've had several requests to do a program like this. Been a little bit negligent getting to this, as we've had a lot of requests to do various kind of programs. But once again, again that book. If you are a parent, single parent, or parents with a special needs child, you can get it at most libraries, as Hal mentioned, as it got starred by libraries around the country. It's called A Complete Guide to Creating a Special Needs Life Plan by Hal Wright. That's Wright. I'm Jim Poplava. Thanks for listening.
The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Please be advised that you invest at your own risk.